This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Student entrepreneurs at NC State have a special place to go with their projects. It's called the garage. It's not the kind of place you park your car, though one student does keep his motorcycle there. His name is Andrew Meisenheimer. He's a grad student at State, and through the university's entrepreneurship program, he started a business called Spark Moto. He's designing an electrical supercharger for motorcycles that he works on in the garage. NC State began encouraging young innovators with its Engineering Entrepreneurs program in the early 1990s. It has since expanded school-wide and become the Entrepreneurship Initiative. It brings students from diverse disciplines with the goal of getting them started in the world of business. The garage is one place where businesses are formed and developed, and NC State is just one university, and started to think about colleges as a place where students can launch businesses. With us now are a couple of NC State student entrepreneurs that hang out in the garage. Andrew Meisenheimer, the Electrical Engineering Department, and Angela Holland is in the College of Textiles. And joining us is Tom Miller, Executive Director of the NC State Entrepreneurship Initiative. Welcome to all of you. It's so great to have you here.
Great to be
here.
Thank you.
Angela, let's start by getting you to describe the garage for us. What do we see when we go there?
Sure. So the garage is actually a really nifty space that a lot of us can use. We have access to it 24/7. When you go in, it's got bright walls. We've got designs and creative things on some of the different walls. But we've got a library where there's just different books on marketing, on starting a company, on finances, you know, managing teams, all kinds of things. We also have a good selection. And as far as magazines, your Inc., your Wired, your real current event type things for entrepreneurship. And as you proceed into the garage, there's also a common room where we have big screen TVs and we've got different whiteboards and markers and all kinds of things where we can use it as a really creative space between whether you're working on group projects or group feedback or just tossing around ideas. Basically, you can have a large group of people sitting in one area. And then we've got the innovation room. We've got a machine shop where you can, you know, build cabinets. You can build whatever you want. And we've got conferencing capabilities. And then in the back, we've got a nifty little space that Andrew will probably like to share with you a little bit about.
Take a little space up there.
Yeah. Talk about that space, Andrew. What you talking about?
Yeah, so the back space is kind of an electrical area. But just because I had a lot of floor space, I brought my motorcycle in there. And I've had it for a while there, retrofitting the prototype that I've created, the electric supercharger being more motorcyclists want more power, but the current technology is either too dangerous or too expensive. And we see that a lot of, in like how what OEMs are doing. So with the electric supercharger.
OEMs?
Original equipment manufacturers.
I see. Go
Sorry.
Ahead.
Lingo. But yeah, so what it is it's instantaneous and you cut on and off. So that it conserves your fuel economy from your stock bike. But the major benefit is that it gives power, but it also has sensors on the bike for safety. So you can get on, you can drive, but it's also looking out for you. No other competitor or manufacturer can provide that. So we're really excited about it, get a lot of great interest, and that's what we're hoping to release out there in the motorcycle industry for a lot of enthusiasts.
And you ride a bike, so you figured out this is something that you wanted.
Rode and crashed a motorcycle, so I've had the ups and downs.
And you decided you wanted a device that makes it go faster.
Yes, yeah. So being a guy wanting to go fast, I mean, but I also have seen the hard knocks of it, and the garage has been a really great opportunity for that because I live in a small apartment and don't have a lot of space there to house a motorcycle, especially that the landlord wouldn't be too happy about it. So I get some space there to work with a lot of the tools. So it's great, too, because there's a lot of resources there that would be really expensive for me to try to provide myself, being I'm paying for student loans and doing the regular school life. But, man, it's a great community there.
Tom, how did it get started?
The garage or the
yeah the garage
part?
The garage
the garage
yeah.
It was an idea that was really a long time coming, and I've been working with student entrepreneurs, as you said, since the early 1990s, and engineering to begin with, but now university wide, and we realized at some point, you know, we really needed a place that was conducive to creativity, that had some of the resources that these guys have talked about. The places to meet, to do presentations, to share ideas, to work on things. So it's sort of a think of it as a business incubator for students in a way. And We have for 8 years taken a group of students out to Silicon Valley for spring break, and both of these guys have gone on that trip. And, you know, some of the legendary garages are out there, the garage where Hewlett-Packard began, the garage where Apple Computer began. And so actually Steve Walsh, who heads the Engineering Entrepreneurs Program now, came up with the idea of the name Garage, and everybody liked it. It stuck. It really captured, you know, the spirit of what we're trying to achieve.
Angela, tell us about your company, Spitters Better.
Yes. So we are a new startup for children's apparel. So we're doing antibacterial clothing, predominantly for infants and toddlers. So, you know, we saw a trend with kids and garments really weren't holding up to the wear and tear that they put on them. And a lot of them are quite expensive for the low durability they actually provide. So what we are doing is basically using some cutting edge technologies, additives with our dyes and whatnot, to actually design clothing that is and can fight bacteria on the interior and exterior.
What's the relationship between bacteria and wear and tear?
So bacteria, a lot of so kids, when you go to daycares or they go out and play, you know, they get messy, they get dirty, they sneeze on each other. You know, a lot of different germs spread from one child to the next. So basically, what we're looking at doing is giving parents a preventative measure through garments. Technology has, you know, given us the capabilities to really improve how garments can react and perform for us. So it's kind of meeting that need. And with the technology comes an added durability. They hold their shape better. And we use eco-friendly dyes and things like that to really give the most value and bang for your buck, if you will.
See, what I thought was if I was thinking of like asbestos clothes so that it'd be fireproof, but then, no, I understand the health risk there. So then you like PCBs or some polyurethane coating then to keep it from, but you don't think that'd be a good idea for kids' clothing?
No, not so much.
And I would learn that in the garage because somebody sitting there, explain how that works. How does, or does it really? I mean, it sounds like a great idea to have a bunch of people sharing ideas from different disciplines. Does that really happen?
It happens all the time. And I think we get our best feedback from the kids that are in, you know, completely different fields or disciplines of study because everybody brings something new to the table and a different perspective. And, you know, I can sit down and create this whole thing and give one, you know, a one-sided, one-dimensional opinion. And then you bring an engineer in or you bring somebody that has, you know, kids and they're like, well, did you think about this? And you're like, oh, not quite yet, but we're on to it, you know. It just really brings a full cycle of innovation and creativity to it and positions you better for success, in my opinion, once you kind of gather that roundtable feedback.
Well, maybe tell us about that, Tom, in terms of business. I mean, clearly you've got the mind, you've thought about this thing, you probably could have come up with it, at least in your apartment. Have you had help on the business side already?
Yeah, actually, so that's what I'm in the process of doing, trying to figure out where exactly I need to stand as a business because you can have the technology is there, and that's where as an engineer, my undergraduate degree is in mechanical engineering, my graduate's in electrical engineering, so I have kind of the clout there and the work, but a lot of great individuals from the business school have been directing me and helping me out with that as advisors. And then even in the community, we have a lot of great investors, business partners, too, that come in from different firms, and they talk to us about it. So
Andrew, how far along the line are you with this then?
We're filing as either an S or C Corp in North Carolina. So we're giving back. We're part of the North Carolina here as a company, and that's a great thing. We're getting really deep into the roots of entrepreneurship and business here in the Raleigh-Durham area.
Tom, how has the outside business community and I guess the engineering world embraced this? Do they know you're here?
They do. And in fact, the garage, the publicity from the garage got a lot of attention. And we've got a lot of mentors from the community, a lot of entrepreneurs within the community that, you know, many, in fact, I've known as students that have come back and want to help the current students. And so we have a lot of those that talk to these guys. Plus others, we have attorneys and accountants, intellectual property specialists, et cetera, that are very happy to volunteer their time to meet and talk with the students.
And the whole idea got a big boost from Red Hat, right?
It did. We got a grant from Red Hat to outfit this little space that is now the garage. So, yeah.
And it's been – tell us about the journey because we talked about this being an engineering entrepreneurship and now it's gone school-wide. Tell us about the trajectory and the journey of this particular idea from the start. You've been there from the beginning.
Yeah, from the beginning. It actually started back in the 80s. I had an open door policy for students, and those that marched to the beat of a different drummer would sometimes come and talk to me for hours about their ideas, their dreams, their aspirations of being the next Steve Jobs or the next Bill Gates. And by gosh, some of those students actually did it along the way. And I had my own experience as an accidental entrepreneur in 1990 when I developed some software that GE was interested in. And they were only interested if it were a commercial product. So very naively, I lined up some guys and started a company and found out how much I didn't know about the other aspects of starting a business other than the technology. And it made me realize that, you know, we weren't doing enough for our students. I mean, students come into the university and are basically go out on two paths. One, get a job, or two, go to graduate school. And we're trying to create a third path, which is create a job. And we've not done enough in that regard over the years. And so this is really trying to make that happen.
And I guess it makes perfect sense, Angela, if you think about it, because we're told over and over again that the days are gone when you're going to get out of school and get a job for 30 years, and probably you're going to go from one to another, and most likely along the way you may end up starting your own business. So I guess you've got a leg up there.
Yeah. School, the way that our curriculum is taught, especially in College of Textiles, I know engineering is the same way. It's very project heavy, and we have a lot of work with different companies and industry reps in undergrad. So we got a lot of great experience as far as how do you develop a product, how do you pitch it, how do you things like that, the kind of intro steps, and a lot of different products that are really awesome are, you know, pitched in class settings. But then, you know, everybody, like that we were just talking about, thinks they either have to go to grad school or they have to get a real job, and they forget about it. And I got into watching a lot of these senior class presentations and these products, and they're really revolutionary. And I don't know, I just kind of clicked, and I was thinking, you know, if I can do it and Andrew can do it, there's a lot more people that really can do it, and they have what it takes. You know, it's just they don't know what way and what avenue to go. So the EI has done a really good job for helping.
Is there a way,
us.
Though, forgive me, I'm sorry, but is there a way, Andrew, that if you get an idea and you get going on it too soon, you might get too narrow in education. You might, your focus might be too narrow.
Well, I mean, so that's kind of like where you get a lot of depth. So, I mean, originally going into a master's, that is to get some of that depth, some of the specialized knowledge. But that's where the garage really brings it back a level to say there's a lot of other opportunities out there. And I would say not only do I have kind of a specialized skill, but I can wear many hats. And I think that's where we're kind of taught that at university too, is that even if you go into industry, I've worked with a lot of large companies. They're looking for entrepreneurs too, more like entrepreneurs. Because when you get out and you start working with them, they love to see people that go above and beyond the duty in the work setting. And that's where I carry that through me, whether I'm working with a large company, whether I'm working on my small company. And that's something it's really hard to teach students, but as a community and as a group of students, we really push each other and we start teaching that to ourselves as we drive through these projects that Andrew has talked about.
And, you know, we do this all in the context of this changing environment now. It's not the way it was 30 years ago. Universities are changing. And to get a sense of how things are changing, we're going to ask David Townsend to join us now. David Townsend is Assistant Professor of Entrepreneurship in the Department of Management and Innovation at NC State. David, welcome.
Thank you so much.
There have been periods of more or less innovation in American history. Give us an idea of the sort of the trend, the ups and downs of entrepreneurship and innovation in American history.
You know, it's sort of an interesting question because I think historically entrepreneurship has been important since the country was founded. But I don't think people realized how important it was. And so not really until the 1970s when the Carter administration started to do some studies to figure out how to solve their unemployment crisis, which is not all that dissimilar to what we're currently experiencing, and started to look at where most of the major new jobs were coming from and realized, lo and behold, it's these small, high-growth companies that are predominantly creating the jobs in the country. And that started a sort of a process over the last few decades where we've grown more and more awareness of who's actually driving economic growth, who drives the innovative new products, new services, new technologies like these great students were just chatting about. And so now I think we're seeing a large movement towards this. And over the last few years, there's been just an enormous amount of interest in entrepreneurship, and you know, in government public policy circles or in universities or other settings where we're trying to think about all these problems we currently have, how do we solve them?
Yeah, and it seems to me a fundamental shift in the economy and the way entrepreneurship works is that now you can work at a smaller level. In an industrial economy, you have a few big automakers, you have a few big steel makers. So innovators and entrepreneurs are going to be pretty much scooped up in those industries working for U.S. Steel or GM. Now you have a better chance, don't you, David, or am I wrong about this, of working for yourself and starting your own company?
And that's one of, I think, the most positive trends is that you absolutely do. And so kind of two trends are kind of converging to help us with this particular problem. On one hand, there's sort of a methodology that's emerging called Lean Startup, which kind of takes people through a process, an experimental process of trying to figure out what the market need, what the problem that somebody is actually solving, and trying to develop some kind of a technological solution to solve that problem. So we talk a lot about this product market fit. And so in that capacity, you're seeing a lot more startups being able to get going for a lot lower levels of capital. And so we worked in a startup about 10 years ago during the first dot-com era, and it cost us over $1 million to program our technology. And now the same technology could be programmed for under $10,000. And so, you know, we're sort of getting smarter about how we go about doing that. And there's just a lot of other resources that are being brought to bear. And so one of the other major trends, as we talked about universities, is that universities are jumping into the game and trying to get students engaged at an early level to experiment with new ideas to see what could have some traction in the market, what could solve a major problem, and do it in a university setting when there's a lot more room for error and it's a lot less costly to try to come up with a new great breakthrough idea.
Yeah, David, it sounds like the university, certainly at NC State, they're catching on to this idea and now in the advanced guard in thinking about how to generate, make the experience more profitable. Are you worried, though, that at the primary and secondary levels, particularly when we're looking at budget cuts, that kids might not be prepared to come into this environment that you're creating now as it's more and more difficult to get a quality education at lower levels?
You know, I think that's certainly an issue, and I think we spend a lot of time talking about, you know, education. We have programs at NC State, actually, where one of our instructors goes over and works with one of the middle school students on entrepreneurship, and they kind of write basic business plans, and they kind of work through a product idea and get some exposure to it so that by the time, hopefully, they get into NC State, they have the entrepreneurship bug, and they're having some level of expertise to be able to engage with the curriculum at a particular level. But I think there is a broader societal sort of challenge that we have as far as getting people to engage, you know, in the type of activity we want in entrepreneurship. And so one of the things we try to do with our students is just, you know, encourage them, expose them to new ideas, and get them engaged with what I talk about, their passions. I mean, what are they really passionate about doing? What really gets them excited? And find that whatever deficiencies they could have, that tends to overcome it because it gives them the drive to work through, you know, gaps in their education or challenges that they face. And that's one thing we find across all entrepreneurs is that the one common element is they're all very generally very passionate people and very committed towards making their venture work.
Tom, we can imagine that engineering and business might come together in the garage. What other disciplines find their way to the garage?
It's actually a broad spectrum. It depends on the student who's leading it and what kind of skills and capabilities they need. But we've had students from humanities that are working on color-coded guitar strings, and they've had some success with that. We've had teams that involved engineering students, computer scientists, and education students getting together, looking at the problem of technology in the classroom, trying to come up with some innovations around that area. So it's very broad. One thing that I have noticed is that when students, the broader the team in terms of their areas of background and interest, the more excitement it generates because they're bouncing ideas off of each other and things they hadn't thought about before.
We're going to continue this conversation, but I'm going to say goodbye to you, Andrew and Angela. Andrew Meisenheimer is an NC State grad student in the Department of Electrical Engineering, creator of Spark Moto, specializes in electric superchargers for motorcycles. Angela Holland is an NC State grad student in the College of Textiles and the creator of children's clothing company called Spitters Better. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank you.
We will continue our conversation on entrepreneurship at NC State when our program continues after this. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking about entrepreneurs and businesses. We think about companies looking, when we talk about this, you always think about the bottom line, a single bottom line, namely money. But there is a trend that hopes to reshape the bottom line, the so-called triple bottom line, social entrepreneurship, if you will. It considers not only profit, but if the company is doing some good in the world and good with its own employees as well. We have with us Tom Miller, who's executive director of the NC State Entrepreneurship Initiative. David Townsend is assistant professor of entrepreneurship at the Department of Management and Innovation and Entrepreneurship at NC State. But joining us now is Micah Gilmer, and he is a clinical assistant professor of social innovation at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Micah, welcome.
Good to be here.
You know, the idea that there is a professorship of social innovation is great. How long has that been a position at UNC?
Well, yeah, it really was. One way to say it is it was tailor-made for me. The other way to say it is that I was building the ship building the plane as I was flying it. I came on to UNC 2 years ago, really fresh out of graduate school, having started a social venture as a graduate student and really interested in providing those resources to students at UNC Chapel Hill. So we had some existing resources around entrepreneurship, but none of those folks were coming from a social background in terms of being deeply involved in the nonprofit community and the government sector. And that's really where my sort of background is and my interest is. So I'm really coming at this from a social perspective.
And tell us about your venture, the thing that got you going.
Yeah, so I started a consulting firm along with two partners, Marcus Littles, who lives in New York, and Ryan Bowers in Philadelphia. We started Frontline Solutions, which is a social change organization that does three things. One thing we do is invest in the pipeline of emerging social change leaders. That's really important to us. We also invest in three fields, work around males of color, work around social innovation, and also work around education. And then we also sort of do consulting services for nonprofit organizations and foundations.
And you thought up something called Capital Kitchen that you found to help business people get going. Describe that for us.
Yeah, so Capital Kitchen was a really fun marriage of the work that I do at UNC, the work that I've learned to do at Frontline Solutions, and some students that I had a chance to interact with. So my father-in-law, Steve Woodyard, has worked in the restaurant industry for almost 40 years, and he's done everything from be a COO of a startup to be a general manager of a large operation. And so I've been pushing him for a long time to get involved in the consulting world. And then I had two fantastic students, both of which I've taught at UNC, also both of which worked as fellows for Frontline Solutions in the summertime, Shruti Shah and Ricky Hurtado, and really sort of put the ball in their court, said I had this idea for this consulting firm, do no upfront consulting services for small businesses. And they just really took it and ran with it.
And what does that mean, upfront consulting for small businesses?
Yeah, so a single operator restaurant, so a small sort of family-owned mom-and-pop sort of operation, doesn't have the capital laying around to pay $30,000 or something for a consultant to come in and fix their operation. So really what we do is to provide them consulting services free of charge up front and then take a percentage of their increase in revenue. So the idea is that Capital Kitchen doesn't get paid until the customer gets paid, right? Until our restaurant gets paid. And as they begin to see an increase in revenue, we take a percentage of that revenue for a fixed amount of time.
And where is the social entrepreneurship in all of this?
Yeah, so there's really two pieces, one of which is the service itself is targeted towards traditionally underrepresented businesses. So we're working right now with Dame's Chicken and Waffles, which is an African-American-owned business, the sort of business that might not have access to these things.
Restaurant in Durham.
Restaurant in Durham, yeah. Right on Main Street,
yeah.
Home of the famous sweet potato waffle. and then the other piece of it is that we're working with Alice Ammerman at UNC Chapel Hill, who does work around food systems, as well as Molly DeMarco there, around creating small-scale investments in food infrastructure. So whether that's investing in a community that doesn't have access to groceries, investing in sort of healthy school lunches, we're still figuring that piece out. But the idea is to reinvest a portion of that revenue in a social venture.
And so this keeps money local. It keeps businesses going. It generates local jobs and the money circulating. David Townsend, again, as we look back at the sweep of entrepreneurship and innovation in this country, one of the things that fascinates me is that Michael Porter is now running around the country, Michael Porter of the Harvard Business School, talking about the triple bottom line as an absolute business proposition that businesses cannot afford to ignore the social context in which they work, the infrastructure, the education, the job situation in their communities, because it will affect in the long run their profit. So we're not talking about do-gooding for doing good. We're talking about do-gooding for your own single bottom line, which is profit. Is that part of the trend these days, David?
Yeah, and it's really kind of a fascinating trend to watch unfold, because you're seeing a lot of businesses, recognize that what's under the demand for their products is the fact that the product has to create value for the customer. And, you know, and you look at the major crises we have around unemployment or poverty or hunger or all these different things, there's great businesses that could be launched to solve those problems, and the founders make money at the same time. You know, how is that necessarily a bad thing? And I think the greatest example of that in my mind is Muhammad Yunus, won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2006, largely for his work with Grameen Bank. And Grameen Bank kind of came out of this story where he was walking through a village and saw these local artisans working on leather goods and kind of started to investigate how the economy actually worked for them and realized that it would only take $27 of money that he had in his pocket and he can actually buy the goods for these folks to get them freed from their money lenders, and basically spun that into a business that's made, you know, billions of dollars in loans over the last 20 years, and 90% of the borrowers are moms who have been widowed, they have children, basically excluded from the economy, and help them sort of pull themselves out of their out of the poverty they were in. And one of the things I used to show my students is I'd put up the major economic returns or profitability ratios of most of our larger commercial banks in the world up against Grameen Bank, and in a lot of cases Grameen Bank was twice as profitable, even though it was run basically as a nonprofit, was twice as profitable because it was creating this really compelling social value and profit really at the same time. They just chose to use their profit to feed into the growth of their organization. And so now we're seeing a greater awareness of this just across the board of people saying, you know, as my Professor Porter sort of focuses on, that value is not just the sort of economic exchange, that it's sort of multidimensional and encompasses all these different factors that we need to consider.
Tom Miller, how does it feel to you as somebody who got this thing going because you had an idea and saw a need in a university to bring people together, to now see that the outside business world is recognizing some of this as a real business interest and not just an academic concern?
Well, it's not really a surprise to me. I think that the outside world, the business world, gets it and has gotten it for years. I think the thing that's really new is that the university's getting it from the inside. When I started doing this in the early 90s, I didn't get an awful lot of encouragement from my colleagues, but I had a grant from the National Science Foundation, so it was okay to do it. Mm-hmm. But now it's a totally different story. It's well respected and well recognized within the university, and it's a good thing.
Micah, can all socially responsible ideas be for-profit ventures? Is there a place in the world for nonprofit? How do you see things working with those two worlds, the nonprofit world and the smaller profit world?
Yeah, I think that's exactly the question. For us, in the work I do at UNC, it's really about helping students understand ways in which to generate revenue for their ventures. But more importantly, there are things that need doing in terms of the larger societal impact piece that are not profitable, right? It's not profitable to provide education to low-income students or to give medical care to folks that don't have insurance. There's no way to really make money doing that, right? So the question for social innovation is, how do we take what we're learning in the entrepreneurship space and really translate that to the context that really can impact the larger societal problem? So job creation is a piece of that, but it's not the end-all be-all in terms of solutions for our society.
Well, David Townsend, you were talking about the fact that there are these opportunities now. We do have, we've identified the problem. It's education, it's housing for people with low incomes and all of that sort of thing. The market has said, you know what, we don't really make a big enough profit making housing for poor people, and educating poor people doesn't really turn a profit. Are we just not thinking creatively about this, and are these entrepreneurial incubators like NC State the places where we might see solutions grow?
And I think there's a lack of creativity. I mean, Muhammad Yunus faced a lot of opposition around his initial idea with Grameen Bank, but he came up with this very unique business model that enabled him to get over some of the hurdles that people rightfully identified. They just didn't come up with a creative solution for it. And so I think, some of the major – I mean, I always sort of – I'll grant it as a theoretical point that, that there are some things that probably – are better suited for nonprofit ventures. But I think the exciting thing is that as we focus on business model innovation, we'll see a lot more creative ideas come out where we could leverage all the enormous resources and, in private equity markets, from large corporations to venture capital funds, to leverage those resources to address some of these fundamental problems. And so I think, you know, broadly, there needs to be a lot more creativity, and which is why I think universities play a critical role in that, because we operate where we have, you know, students with lots of idealism and lots of ambition, you know, and so they don't tend to be constrained by, you know, the old business models or the ways that we think this is the way you should do business. They're far more creative, and so if we can give them some structure and some resources and some guidance, I think we'll see students continue to launch these incredible new ventures to address some of these fundamental problems that we face.
Mike, I wonder how much of it really rests with the way we finance new ideas. Right now, if you're going to finance anything through Wall Street, there will be a demand for highest return on investment. So if I can build a small school for poor children, or I can build a microprocessing plant, the money's going to go to the plant. That's the imperative, the way it works. Is there a need for some other kind of financing system, a small profit universe that allows for a slightly investors to understand going in that they're going to get a smaller return, but a return nonetheless, and this is our stock market for just that? It feels like that place hasn't been made yet, that's the stumbling block.
Yeah, I think that's one of the real challenges. So there's been a move even in the nonprofit sector towards thinking about return on investment in a social context. So the move over the last 10 to 15 years towards evaluation of programs has been about that. It's been about quantifying the return that we're going to have socially. But what that has done is really placed in the hands of a few powerful nonprofits that have the ability to do a comprehensive program evaluation of those resources. So how do we take those resources and take the ideas and learnings that have been evaluated that we know that are successful and translate them into broader context? That's really how you achieve scale in the nonprofit sector. How do we translate the things that we're learning from programs that work with youth to athletics, which half of all young people are doing, rather than a very small percentage that are served by other programs? So I think that's really the cutting edge, right, is how do we take the things that are sort of revenue generating or sort of able to garner resources, translate what they're learning to the places where there may not be a revenue generating opportunity, but there are volunteers and folks working in communities that already want to do this stuff.
But it means we have to learn how to measure those costs. What is the cost of a poorly educated child growing into adulthood in my community? If I know what that cost, and then who is paying that cost? And it seems to me we've done not a very good job of assessing that and then assigning those things, because I think once we knew, we'd make some better decisions about where to put our tax money and how much to pay.
Yeah. I think there's some of that work out there. I think it's still hard, even if you're able to make the argument that this child will, if they're, you know, in prisons or something like that, it costs this much to society. There's folks that have – that research is out there. Mm-hmm. But it's still hard to make that argument and make that case when folks are deciding whether to raise taxes or where to put sort of move the pencils or move the marbles around in terms of federal or state dollars.
Well, David Townsend, I mean, is that the next frontier, is to raise consciousness about the way we're spending our money and the losses that we incur by not measuring social value and the social costs?
I think in general, the problem of externalities, you know, in general is not even in just social entrepreneurship, but just the economy in general is the major question. I mean, I think if we look at the breakdown of the financial markets with the mortgage crisis and others, it's basically, you know, the lack of full appreciation for the social cost of different activities. And so in social entrepreneurship, I think that's absolutely the critical thing. And so being able to understand exactly how, you know, like you say, the cost, the example has been given, the cost of not educating a child, what's the long-term societal cost? And I think as we sort of boil that down to something actionable for entrepreneurs, it's what's the real value proposition that the firm's trying to deliver? Those are the calculations that we want entrepreneurs to make. We want them to come up with some keen insight into by not doing this. And if we're able to here's the cost of not doing this, and so if we're able to come up with a solution for that, you know, and be able to work capital markets and others, then we have some ability to start to address that problem.
Tom, do you see students at State thinking about businesses from a social entrepreneurship standpoint?
Absolutely. They're young and they're untainted. I mean, as Dave mentioned earlier, passion is a big driver. And we encourage the students to work on something that they're passionate about. Otherwise, they're not going to work as hard as they need to be successful. And a lot of them have, socially oriented kinds of passions and ideas. And I think that's a good thing. And we'll encourage them to pursue those passions. It is difficult, though. I mean, as Micah pointed out, the numbers are out there. About the cost of dropouts and prisons and things like that. But I don't know. It's an indirect cost in a way. And that's where it becomes difficult. I mean, there's that indirect relationship, and the government has to end up paying for this. I mean, society's paying through the government,
right.
And the political will is a big factor there.
David, we've been talking a lot about students, but immigrants are also involved in entrepreneurship in local communities as well, aren't they?
And they play a crucial role. I mean, in the technology field, there's some recent studies that have estimated about 25% of our high technology companies are started by immigrants. And so they, you know, in fact, they face some pretty considerable obstacles to stay, but they still have been really the backbone of technology entrepreneurship in the U.S.
So, Micah, have you seen any results so far? Let's take Dames for one, the mm-hmm. chicken and waffle shop. It's a great idea, of course. How are they doing?
They're doing well. I think, you know, they're a new business. They came out of a very successful catering operation for a number of years. But in terms of the food service industry, there's still a learning curve there. I think one thing we've been able to do is help them sort of get food out of the kitchen quicker, get folks served a little quicker. And I think we're going to continue to work with them over the next few months to continue to help them with their operation.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Micah Gilmer is a clinical assistant professor of social innovation at UNC Chapel Hill. David Townsend, assistant professor of entrepreneurship in the Department of Management, Innovation, and Entrepreneurship at NC State. Tom Miller is the executive director of the NC State Entrepreneurship Initiative. Thank all of you for being on the program. Great to have you.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things. You can find us on the web at stateofthings.org. Follow us on Facebook. This is North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio.